Okay, welcome back, everyone. We had spent the previous few weeks discussing the Jewish philosophy with regard to slavery. And we spent some time on that. Last time we explored the dueling Civil War sermons of on the eve of the Civil War. And what I'd like to do is to begin to transition from the topic of slavery to a related but really conceptually separate topic, but because it overlaps, I think it's really fascinating to explore. And that is two fundamentally different traditions of ethics that exist perhaps in Judaism, as we'll have to explore, and certainly in the Western canon, Western philosophy, prominently, as we'll see, in Christian philosophy as well. And that's, on the one hand, the notion of natural law, and on the other hand, the tradition of social contract. And these are not necessarily contradictory or mutually exclusive systems of government and of ethics, but they are often put aside one another. What do I mean by natural law, and what do I mean by social contract? So the question essentially is, on what basis do we organize governments? Or on what basis does one individual have a right to exert any sort of authority over another? This is where we can start to see the issue of slavery and ownership, property, begin to come into the conversation. So one tradition is what's known as the natural law tradition. The natural law tradition stipulates that there's some inherent notion of morality and ethics. There's some sense that somehow, either based on my pure rationality or because perhaps a divinely inspired sense of sort of a moral compass that we have within us, that I have the ability to determine on my own, sort of naturally, as it were, what is the proper path to take. You can say this as sort of a softer sense of morality, sort of the right thing to do. You can say it in a stronger sense. You can say it as a sense of natural law, or it's something that really becomes binding, that's really obligatory. And it's a long tradition. We're going to come back to that in a few moments and unpack that a little bit and give a sense of the history of this particular tradition. The other tradition we're going to look at, a little bit less today, a little bit more perhaps next time, is what we call the social contract tradition. The social contract tradition essentially pushes back against the natural law. Natural law says that the way that we organize governments, the way that we organize society, and the basis for ethics is sort of this internal sense of that which is right. Social contract argues essentially that we can't rely necessarily on this notion of natural law, of my own moral compass. Your moral compass is not my moral compass. I can easily bend or twist or sort of use, right? I can sort of redefine that which constitutes natural law for my own interest, and so it can be abused. And so therefore, there's an alternative sort of philosophy or system for the basis for legitimate governments, in particular known as the social contract tradition. And so this tradition will claim, when it comes to at least the way that we organize ourselves as peoples, as institutions, and in particular as states, that essentially this notion that, for example, the monarch or the ruler has this divine right, or this natural right of kingship, what was called the divine right of kings in the medieval period, that is nonsensical, that is just a very convenient, and we have that, by the way, nowadays, even in non-monarchies, we still have a sense of this, right, sort of this destiny, right? Putin, I don't think, right? It's not, I don't think it's the basis of social contract. I think it's destiny, in a sense. So there are sort of non-religious ways of invoking natural law, as we'll see as well. And other enlightened thinkers, over the course of especially the modern period, beginning especially 17th century, as we'll see, have argued that no, that's an illegitimate basis for dominion or for government and so on and so forth. And instead, the fundamental basis for the right of any ruling class to engage in governance of a particular state or society is the notion of social contract, which is either an explicitly stated or an implicitly understood agreement among all the people who come to the tables, represented perhaps ultimately by the government, to rule in a particular kind of way. This is famously the position of Locke, and this makes its way into the Declaration of Independence, and we're going to have to examine that whole tradition as well. Now, where do both of these come in with regard to the question of slavery? How does that sort of segue into this whole conversation? So it's in particular of this issue of natural law, because governance, in a sense, is my right, essentially, to rule over you or anyone. And so the notion of slavery or property ownership in general, especially when it comes to interpersonal relationships, really flows from this question of natural law. And what gives me the natural right, or does not give me the natural right, to own, in this context, a slave or another human being? And so there's a very interesting discussion that sort of unfolds over the course of generations, and it's rooted in some of the sources that we've seen and also in some sources that we have not seen. So what I'd like to do is to transition or to segue to this discussion of natural law, first of all, first and foremost, and then we'll get to the social contract moving forward, on the basis of some of the sources that we find in regard to the basis for slavery. So there were those who argue that natural law, the sort of natural sense of two classes, right? The ruling class and essentially the enslaved class or that lower class is something that is essential to the very nature of humanity. That has a long tradition and goes all the way back to one of the great thinkers of Western philosophy. It's, of course, Aristotle, and in his Politics, in source number one, we're not going to read the whole thing, but we'll read some significant parts of this passage. He asks the following question. He says, "But is there anyone thus intended by nature to be a slave? Does natural law essentially dictate that there are those who are meant to be enslaved, and for whom such a condition is expedient and right? Or rather, is not all slavery a violation of nature?" Aristotle essentially poses the question, what is the natural state of things? Now, just to root this in Aristotle's overall philosophy, Aristotle had a very heavy teleological approach. So what I mean by that is telos is sort of the sense of purpose. Aristotle believed, sort of a little bit different than the way Plato understood things, that essentially everything in this world has an inherent function or purpose, a sense of design. So, for example, if I look at this table, so if Plato looked at this table, what would Plato do? Right? Okay, we're Plato. We're Platonic right now. So, you know, according to Plato, what do we think about when we think this table? This is a mere shadow of what? But Plato always has the Platonic, right? We always talk about the Platonic table, Platonic chair, or there are other, right? Actually, in high school, you should talk about platonic relationships. That's a separate conversation. But the sense that everything that we have here on this earth is just a mere image or shadow of sort of the ideal, whatever it may be. That's not how Aristotle saw things. He didn't see things as sort of the sense that there's something down here which is imperfect and there's some conceptual abstract perfection that's out there. Aristotle says something very simple. He says, well, if you examine the component parts of what it means to be a table, so a table, clearly there's some functions that are not very inherent to a table. So for example, a table makes generally a poor tennis racket. That's just not... it's just not going to work. It happens not to be an example that Aristotle gives, but you kind of get the idea. A table clearly has a particular function, right? And you start to examine it. Well, it's standing up. It's well supported, right? And you start to put things on it, and the way it's, because of the way it's engineered, things are well supported, right? Where I look at a chair, right? So a chair seems to have, right, a basic function, and it's something that is inherent to the design of the chair. So Aristotle, with this teleological approach, he examines that or applies that mode of thinking not only to inanimate objects, but to all of us as well. And he begins to ask fundamental questions such as, what is the very nature, descriptively, of what it means to be a human being? How are we wired? How are we made to function on the basis of everything that he at least knew about human physiology and so on and so forth? And on that basis, what can we extract about what the sort of perfect or ideal human being is meant to be? And so he studies us descriptively, asks sort of what is our function. He speaks about things like intelligence, and he does talk about an internal sense of ethics and goodness and so on. And he tries to extrapolate what the good life is on the basis of this sense of what he essentially calls natural law. It's really what it is. It's natural law in the sense that encoded within us is a certain kind of orientation, a compass toward behaving, acting in a certain kind of way, just like a table has a certain kind of function, the chair is a function, so too we have a set of functions as well. So this is a very common mode of thinking for Aristotle. He even would analyze the plays, the Greek tragedies of his day, and analyze what are the essential components in sort of, right, the perfect or the ideal kind of play, and what is the sort of the function of a play, and so on and so forth. That was how he engaged with aesthetics and poetry and all of those kinds of things, theater, etc. How does that apply here? So when it comes to slavery, he asks this fundamental question. What is the nature of humanity when we go and engage in scientific sort of descriptions or observation about the nature of humanity? See, Aristotle is one of the earliest sort of modern scientists in that sense. Not modern, obviously, by his time, but the way that he extrapolated information by simply engaging in observation, Aristotle organized the animal kingdom into all sorts of different classes, which became a very early form of some of the scientific categories. Obviously, it's very different nowadays, but the ones, sort of that mode of thinking of classifying different types of animals and so on and so forth, Aristotle did all of those things. So what about this question? What is the nature of humanity? Are we meant to be two classes? Are we meant to have those who are enslaved and those who subjugate? Or is that nonsense and that's not our nature? And Aristotle is, as typical, not very subtle. He's quite direct. So if you look in paragraph number 2, there is no difficulty in answering this question on grounds both of reason and of fact, for that some should rule and others be ruled is nothing not only necessary, but expedient. From the hour of their birth, some are marked out for subjugation, others for rule. Okay? Wow. Okay, this wouldn't go over well necessarily nowadays, but good thing for Aristotle is that he died a long time ago.
Subjection, not subjugation. That's correct.
Subjection, excuse me. And I read it. Okay, but you're saying there's a distinction between subjection and subjugation?
Well, not a huge distinction.
You can be a subject and not be...
Right. Right. Well, I want to be careful with a translation from Greek.
So, right.
And given that my Greek is still a work in progress, I'll confess, I'm not sure the...
You translated this from Greek?
Did I translate? I said it's still a work in progress. We're not quite there yet, but I have some students who can probably give me a hint. No, my Greek is poor. I don't speak Greek. It's all Greek to me, as they say. I don't know. I don't know if you can read a sort of a translation and make diukim, as they say in it. But so there is.
How he starts off asking, "Is it a violation of nature?" Even like that. That's what he asks, but then he says it's not.
Right. But he's open to the notion, and then he closes the door. That's correct. And we'll see others close the door in the opposite direction and find themselves on the other side. We're not going to read the larger paragraph here, but essentially what he argues is that this notion of that which is subjugating and that which is subjugated is actually inherent to the way that we all work. And that essentially we are made of, and this is, again, classic Aristotle, of two components. We've got our material parts, or sort of lowly base physicality, and then we have a soul or an intellect, really, that is able to gain mastery over our sort of material, crass, earthly desires. And basically for Aristotle, we have these two components, and they war, and they jockey, and they fight back and forth. It's like those two angels, right, and the one on each shoulder, right? So he internalizes them, and they're in a constant fight. And Aristotle essentially says that if we were to ask anyone in society, or just make a series of observations, which person is superior? The person who allows their earthly, bestial physicality to rule their intellect and their sense of morality and discipline and so on, or vice versa, whom would we prefer? Right? I call it the dinner test, right? Who would you rather go out to eat with, right? Someone who's like shuffling, right? Or someone with proper manners. So Aristotle says, well, it's pretty obvious that a person who has a sense of self-discipline and self-control and basically mind over matter, we'd probably all agree that that's a superior person. So that's what he establishes in paragraph number 1. And then he says, well, let's then extend that to not just within one person, but between people. And is it not the same fundamental principle that there is this tension? And just as there is the soul and there is the physicality, so too there are different individuals who tend toward these different poles, which is a jump, but that's what he says. And he writes in the bottom paragraph, where then there is such a difference as between soul and body, or between men and animals, he had already established that as well, the lower sort are by nature slaves, and it is better for them, as for all inferiors, that they should be under the rule of a master. For he who can be, and therefore is another's, and he who participates in rational principle enough to apprehend but not to have such a principle, is a slave by nature. Whereas the lower animals cannot even apprehend the principle, they obey their instincts. And indeed, the use made of slaves and of tame animals is not very different, for both with their bodies minister to the needs of life. And so on and so forth. In other words, essentially what you have is this same dichotomy exists with regard to relationships between different kinds of human beings. And so he concludes, if you look at the top of the next slide, it is clear then that some men are by nature free and others slaves, and that for these latter, slavery is both expedient and right. So Aristotle makes the natural law argument in favor of slavery. And it's not just Aristotle, but as we've seen, surprisingly in many ways, it's Rav Kook as well. I'm not going to reread the passage for those who are here, but just to remind ourselves, Rav Kook in this classic letter with regard to slavery, evolution, and a whole range of really fascinating other topics, essentially claims that slavery is natural. Right? He uses the example of the mine workers. Right? And essentially what he argues, he assumes that a worker in abject and poor conditions is comparable to a slave, or we can extend the same principle to slavery. In other words, a salaried worker under very, very poor conditions, terribly poor conditions, like you find sometimes claims made about some of these factories in China, those kinds of scenarios, or mines in Africa and so on, right, he's extending that to slavery. And Rav Kook essentially argues that it's natural for some people to have to work in that kind of environment, tragically, or it's just the nature of humanity for there to be different classes in that way. So he says, well, we've got two options. We can either allow that to happen on its own, or we can somehow frame that in a legal sense, or he would say, in a halachic sense as well. And essentially, his argument there is that actually slavery is natural, but it can be at least modified a little bit, because if we are at least softened, moderated just a bit in terms of the edge or some of the dramatically negative ramifications of what it means to be a slave. Because, after all, if the slave owner owns the slave, right, so then that individual, the slave owner, will have much more concern for his property. And that's really unfortunate that humanity works in that way. But argues Rav Kook, right, the slave owner would rather not subject the worker to such terrible and dangerous conditions, because after all, he wants him to live another day and to continue. It's completely self-interested, right? There's no question about it, but ultimately works in our favor. So Rav Kook, right, quite some time after Aristotle, right? Aristotle lives in the 4th century BCE, and Rav Kook is from 1865 to 1835. So a little bit of a jump there, but it's very clear to me that even if he didn't directly read the Aristotle, he is clearly drawing from that tradition. We know he certainly had this material through Haskalah. Rav Kook, very interesting, didn't go to college, didn't have a secular education in a formal sense. He was an autodidact. Pretty much everything that he learned was individual. He learned in Velazhen for some time, so did a traditional grounding in Gemara. He studied actually with Rav Elyashiv, the outstanding posek who passed away last few years. Rav Elyashiv's grandfather, I believe, was a Kabbalist of great renown, and Rav Kook studied with him, wrote a classic sefer entitled Leshem Shavo Ve'Achlama, and Rav Kook studied with him. So that was his Kabbalah study, and then a little bit later on, he gained access to works of Maskilim. And that, we know, Rav Kook had extensive access to the works of the Maskilim, and probably through many of those works that he read, he gained exposure to Hegel and to Aristotle, some of the different secular thinkers who clearly had influence and were in dialogue, or Rav Kook was in dialogue with their thinking. Whether or not he read the original is not 100% clear. But it's the influence is unmistakable here. So that's sort of the natural argument in favor for slavery from an Aristotle and from someone as great as Rav Kook alongside. Of course, there are alternative perspectives that are out there which need to be brought to the table, and who greater than Abraham Lincoln, since we're doing all the interdisciplinary stuff, and we cannot talk about slavery and not mention Abraham Lincoln, one of the gedolim of American history, and in fact we have two quotations that are relevant here. One is a fragment of a lecture they delivered on slavery, and then a classic speech on Peoria, which appears in source number 4. We'll look at both these excerpts. So here, Lincoln, we know his perspective on slavery. And we've mentioned that his election was essentially the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of leading the nation from the precipice to war to the real thing. And Lincoln here writes as follows. If A can prove, however conclusively, that he may of right enslave B, right? In other words, essentially a natural law argument that I have the right inherently to enslave someone else because I have a certain stature or skin color or intellectual superiority or whatever it is that gives me the right to subjugate, to enslave someone else. Why may not B snatch the same argument and prove equally that he may enslave A? Every natural law argument that claims, well, I'm superior to you, right, can always be turned around. How do we really prove that I'm superior, right? Why can't someone make exactly the opposite claim? You say A is white and B is black. Well, that's easy, right? It's skin color, says Lincoln. Take care. By this rule, you are to be slave to the first man you meet with a fairer skin than your own. You do not mean color exactly. You mean the whites are intellectually the superiors of the blacks and therefore have the right to enslave them? Take care again. By this rule, you are to be slave to the first man you meet with an intellect superior to your own. Again, you see where this is going. But say it's a question of interest. And if you can make it your interest, you have the right to enslave another. Very well. Right? And if you can make it his interest, he has the right to enslave you. Says Lincoln, very nice to make a natural law argument, but it's quite convenient that it seems to go in one direction and not in the other. Right? Is it really compelling? Do we really have any meaningful basis on which to argue some are superior to others, and does it really play itself out that way? And might someone who is enslaving others at one point in time find him or herself, right, on just the other side on the basis of the same logical argument used to opposite effect? So natural law arguments, says Lincoln, can really be turned on their heads quite easily, and we have to be intellectually honest about that. And once we are, it really all falls apart. So that's Lincoln number one. And then He invokes something we've already alluded to a little bit in terms of natural law, but also social contract, and a classic oration. He said as follows: "We hold." This is actually. I'll just give you some context. This is one of his debates with Douglas. This is the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates in the Senate race of I think it's 1858. Lincoln lost. Right. He won the presidency 2 years later, but he lost the Senate 2 years before. There's a lesson in that. And Lincoln actually drew lessons from that and spoke about that quite openly and what he had learned from that experience and how it helped him to win and to govern more effectively. But this is debate with regard to some of the issues of the day. In particular, I think this was after... I want to say this was in relation to the Dred Scott decision. I'm not certain. I believe so. And there's a classic decision that the Supreme Court made at the time denying African Americans, or one African American in particular, but as a case which is representative, denying them certain basic civil rights, in particular the right to property, the right to citizenship, I think was the key issue in that case. It's now widely considered to be one of the poorest, if not the poorest, decision in the history of the American legal system, but I believe this came in that context as part of those debates. And so here Lincoln says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Right. So this is, of course, the Declaration of Independence. Now, if I were to ask you, does this sound like natural law? Does this sound like a social contract argument? In social contract, I think definitely the larger language, right? The caps that we're going to see in just a moment, right? But the notion that all men are created equal, is that it, right? So that's already right. That piece of it, I think, goes back to natural law. We'll see that Jefferson gets this from Locke in particular. That these lines are really tweaked from Locke. Locke said, "Life, liberty, and the pursuit of property," and Jefferson says, "The pursuit of happiness." And then there's a big debate whether he meant the same thing but wanted to say it more nicely. He really just meant property, or he meant something wider. But be that as it may, so you have this natural law foundation. But then, as we'll see for Jefferson, it's also somehow put together with social contract. It says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So there's some sort of interplay between the natural on the one hand and the social contract on the other, as opposed to seeing them as two separate traditions. They're able to merge here in Jefferson's thinking, before that in Locke's thinking. We'll sort of see those two streams where they part ways, but then ultimately where they come together, in particular in American thinking. And then Lincoln writes as follows: "I have quoted so much at this time merely to show that according to our ancient faith, the just powers of government are derived from the consent of the governed. Now, the relation of masters and slaves is pro tanto a total violation of this principle. The master not only governs a slave without his consent, but he governs him by a set of rules altogether different from those which he prescribes for himself. Allow all the governed an equal voice in the government, and that only is self government. So Lincoln, we see in one piece, had pushed back against slavery from an natural law perspective, right? There are these two traditions that are out there. So Lincoln says, right, natural law, forget about it. Any argument you can make, I can turn right on its head. You're going to tell me social contract? That's clearly, social contract means that all the members of the society are treated the same way. Right? So what are you going to say, right? The social contract is just for the white land-owning Americans? Is that how you conceptualize this? That's quite convenient as well. So could say that if you wanted, but he says, if it's a true social contract that equally applies to all the participants in the country, right, or all the members, so then it needs to be fair in that way. So natural law doesn't hold up, social contract doesn't hold up, slavery doesn't hold up. This is sort of the two prongs of Lincoln's position. Another exemplar of, in particular, natural law pushing back against slavery is in Rousseau. Rousseau, one of the great social contract thinkers, also this classic work is actually called The Social Contract. Again, we'll come back to this. But he writes with regards to slavery, since no man has a natural authority over his fellow and force creates no right, we must conclude that conventions form the basis of all legitimate authority among men. Right? Conventions. Right? Read. Social contract, right? And this is Rousseau after he was a little bit of sick and tired of the French monarchy and all the abuses thereof. He says, enough with all of this. Can't just get up and declare yourself divinely, right, benighted, right, divinely appointed to rule with an iron fist in abusive fashion over all of us, right? This needs to stem from the people. Our conventions form the basis of all legitimate authority among men. An individual, says Grotius, who's a classic as a foundational thinker for social contract theory, can alienate his liberty and make himself a slave of a master. Why could not a whole people do the same, make itself subject to a king? There are in this passage plenty of ambiguous words which would need explaining. Let us confine ourselves to the word alienate. To alienate is to give or to sell. Now, a man who becomes the slave of another does not give himself. He sells himself at least for his subsistence. But for what does a people sell itself? The king is so far from furnishing his subjects with their subsistence that he gets his own only from them. And according to Rabelais, kings do not live on nothing. The subject then give their persons on condition that the king takes their goods also. I fail to see what they have left to preserve. So Rousseau, based at the beginning on natural law, and then at the end, social contract, also takes these two prongs and uses them to argue. He says, no man has a natural authority over his fellow. And if you can tell me social contract, again, that's not going to work either. So what you see from these sources is that this question of natural law, sort of Aristotle on the one hand, that tradition, right, and those who are pushing back, whether it's Lincoln in our context or Rousseau before him, right, pushing back, and they're all debating this issue of sort of, yes, social contract, as we'll get to, but also, right, this question of natural law. And I think that that's a really interesting concept and a really interesting category that in Jewish thought, I don't know if we think about in those terms. And I'd like to give it some thought. What exactly is natural law? What is its tradition in Western sources? And then we'll start to discuss, I don't think we'll have enough time to cover it comprehensively, but to open the conversation for tonight, where does Judaism fall on this issue? Is there such a notion of sort of this intuitive or rationally argued sort of self-evident sense of ethics, of morality, of that which is right and wrong? Will there come to slavery or anything, all of ethics? Is that part of our tradition? Is that authentic? Is that other traditions? It's not us.
Okay. We need these rules and this order in order to feel good.
Good, right? So the whole notion of a revelation-based system, in particular with halakha, with laws, right, seems to make it much harder, for some very obvious reasons, to assert that somehow we can just use pure logic. Isn't that the whole purpose of revelation? 100%.
More so when the framework is there, because natural law will be bad.
Mm-hmm.
Lives by natural law, mm-hmm. And obviously it accepts that there is such a thing, because now it's in contrast. We have to have the rules, because what's the alternative?
Well, naturally, we can always postulate, but the question is it a legitimate basis for it? Of course, there are those who would say, but you could argue, look what would happen if we just went based on natural law. Right? Hobbes says natural law is the world of all against all. Right? That's why I called it the Leviathan. Right? Leviathan is not actually is the right. That's the mythic, right? The mythic sea monster. I don't want to say fish. I say sea monster. The Leviathan. We have that. That comes from actually comes from Sefer Iyov. I think is the first reference to the Leviathan, and then plays a prominent role in our tradition as this mythical sea beast, which in the Messianic era is going to go to war and going to be captured and then eaten by the tzaddikim in some grand seuda. Really, really interesting stuff. Hobbes used it in a totally different way. For Hobbes, the Leviathan is actually the state. Because in the natural order of things, you want to know what natural law is? Natural law is basically, for Hobbes, the war of all against all. So we're just going to eat each other alive. Anyone read Lord of the Flies recently? Or any point? Okay, that's right. When I read Hobbes, that's what I thought as well. That's what it is, right? You have these boys who are stuck on this, right? On this island, right? On this island, and they create their own society. And from the beginning, and especially by the end, it all falls apart. I mean, they become a bunch of violent barbarians who are hunting one another and engaging in these barbaric pagan, you know, pig worship. I mean, it's not a very, and if you're looking for a pick-me-up, it's not. Not exactly it. And it's a Hobbesian vision. So, yeah, maybe, even if we're not Hobbesian, but at minimum, we may think that natural law doesn't really work very well, and it doesn't exactly go where we want, and that's why we need halakha, something objective, something divine, to craft our behavior, and maybe that's right. So we're gonna have to see. There are some sources, however, that raises some questions for this issue. So we're gonna have to think about this. Okay. So this whole idea of natural law, though, before we get into a Jewish sources, but just to give some overview, I thought it would be worthwhile. Just I'm not gonna do it in depth, but just to give some basic context. So I just wanna just to sort of trace it historically a little bit. This is not on the source sheet, but just to give you a little bit of background. Again, not to get too into it, but just sort of an overview. So. Probably the godfather of this way of thinking is generally considered to be Aristotle, whom we've already seen. This teleological approach, we can sort of understand the purpose of something on the basis of how it's constructed, its function, right? And so Aristotle certainly is one of the great thinkers to develop this law. Then the next group of individuals or thinkers who developed this are known as the Stoics. Who are the Stoics? I'm going to give about just like six quick points along this spectrum of historical spectrum of thought. Who are the Stoics? Third century, right? Third century thinkers, right? And what do the Stoics claim or believe, right? Stoicism, right? Aristotle is more open to the notion of divinity or notion of religion, and they are extremely skeptical about such things. But what they do claim, and they do essentially construct, is a natural law, but shorn of religiosity, basis for a legal system. And they essentially craft, it's basically what happens when philosophers create law, which I'm not sure is much better or worse than politicians creating law. I think it's a lose-lose, but it is what it is. And so they, shorn of the religious component, they continue this tradition. The Stoics are considered by some to have then impacted on the Gnostics then in turn on Christianity. And so we're going to see natural law in some streams of Christianity as well, which is interesting. After that, we have Cicero. Are you familiar with Cicero? Familiar name? Cicero is a great Roman jurist. He's born in 106 BCE and dies in approximately 43. So the first century BCE, essentially. Cicero is considered to be one of the great Roman jurists of all history. The medievals quoted him all the time. If you read Chaucer, Cicero's everywhere. He's considered one of the great jurists, legal thinkers of all of history. And what he puts on the map is he takes the idea of natural law and he extends it to our civil responsibility. This is one of his big claims about natural law. And basically what he said is that if not every individual takes some measure of responsibility toward the common good, right, toward creating a better society, then essentially society cannot sustain itself. We just can't get where we need to do, what we need to get, if we don't have everyone shipping in. Now, not everyone has to be a jurist or an intellectual or a philosopher like he was, but everyone has to chip in a meaningful way. And if we don't, civil society will collapse. And that's a sort of his essential claim. When I read Cicero, it's very different, but there's shades of, if anyone's seen De Tocqueville, anyone read De Tocqueville? And it's a masterful book, Democracy in America. De Tocqueville is a Frenchman.
In high school.
It's extraordinary. It's just, he describes as a European.
Who comes to America.
Who visits America and spends, I don't know how long it was, a year or 2 years, whatever it is, visiting. And he compares and contrasts European society and American society. And I will say, to our praise, a tremendous accolades that he offers America, and all sorts of really interesting insights, which when you read it, it was written in the 19th century, you're like, oh my gosh, that's us. It's like nothing has changed. It's incredibly insightful, and it's uncanny how much he pegs us. It's really, really, it's a little bit eerie almost how dead on he is. And one of the things that he writes about, which doesn't exist now in the same way that it did then, but to some degree we still have it, it's not the same, is this notion of civil society, these civil communities that we have. In fact, if you look around this community locally, I'm always taken by this, that you see buildings, for example, that represent this kind of civil society, not politics, but I mean people coming together to create organizations for the common good. So you have, you have Meeting House Lane here, right? You have the Meeting House on that corner if you go down on Montgomery Avenue, right? It's called the Meeting House? Is that the name?
Friends.
You know what I'm talking about? What?
Friends.
Friends Meeting House. What's the name of the building on the corner if you're going in, if you're in Narberth and you're on the way down to Acme on the right side, just past Chabad? Is that what it's called? It's a Quaker rite. The Quaker tradition is very much connected with the sense of civil society, and it's a lot what de Tocqueville describes. It's called the Friends Meeting House. Okay. So that's an example. And you have other sort of, and the way that there's like a Lower Merion historical society, and like the way that some of these communities coming from North Jersey, we didn't have that kind of tradition that you have here. Real roots. To me, it's a very special piece of living in a community like this. But it's exactly this, and it goes back to this. It's not exactly Cicero, but to me, there's a certain commonality there, with that sense that even if it's not in terms of politics proper, but we all have a civic responsibility on the basis of natural law for Cicero to contribute to the overall good of our community. Because if we don't all take a sense of responsibility, or nowadays we might say if we don't all vote and so on and so forth, then really the basis for democratic society, we would say, right, is really not going to be able to sustain itself. And we all have to have a sense of responsibility for that. And so Cicero, in his own way, and obviously a different kind of environment and context, makes that argument.
I don't want to distract you.
Yeah.
The new streets, this relates to Lincoln and Union in this area. Union Street is called Union Street because the Union troops went to the train station down Union Street, so they named it Union Street.
And that's, I didn't know that. Interesting. Okay. There's a piece of history there as well. Very nice. Okay. So that's Cicero. I'm going to jump a long time because we're not going to do this entire tradition, but I'm going to jump all the way to the 13th century to give you a sense of how this plays out in a Christian context. And one of the great Christian thinkers who was for that time, was a relative friend of the Jewish people, which frankly didn't take very much in the 13th century, but I guess we'll take what we can get. St. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas lives from, I think I wrote down here. Yeah, 1225 to 1274. Aquinas, one of the great towering figures of Christian thought. And he in particular, he picks up on some others. Augustine, some 800 years earlier, had begun to develop this, but he really develops it much more elaborately. He really marries the notion of religiosity in a more sophisticated kind of way, in Christian context, with natural law. And he is one of the great Christian advocates for natural law tradition, and had dramatic, major impact on later Western thinkers. Many of the thinkers that we're discussing were reading Aquinas and were influenced by Aquinas. And essentially what Aquinas does is he postulates the notion of natural law, and he grapples with how it fits with Revelation. Sort of beginnings of the questions we were raising. Now, it's not the same as when you have commandments. In a Christian context, I think it's a lot easier because you don't have all of the details and all of the commandments, and it's a different... You have revelation, but it's a much more generic kind of thing, and it's less detail-oriented and certainly less comprehensive. So it's not the same question as it is for Judaism, but Aquinas really brings this to the religious sphere, and there are a lot of thinkers, major thinkers, who were influenced by that. If you fast forward to Western Europe, you'll find that that in the modern period, the idea of natural law and the question of natural law comes up again, especially in competition with social contract. Because in particular, sort of there's a sense that in the beginning of the modern period, the early modern period in particular in Western Europe, they're a little bit fed up with the monarchy. You had the Protestant Reformation sometime before that, so the sense of the, certainly the church having, right, in other words, one major source of, right, theocratic power. At that time, of course, the two were married for much of the medieval period, although things were always complicated, Henry VIII, whatever. But you find certainly the twinning of, right, of political authority and ecclesiastical authority, and you found sort of the, for lack of a better term, the degrading of certainly the figureheads, right, whether it be the Pope and of the clergy in the wake of the Protestant Reformation. So then what you have subsequent to that is social contract theorists begin to develop, and they say, who said that you're just automatically the king, right? Who said that just because you appointed yourself so and claimed God's authority, right, that it's necessarily the case? We, the people, they weren't up to democracy, but we should, you see, sort of the seedlings of democracy. We should together choose the monarch. Well, of course, eventually, if we choose not a monarch, but rather a democratically elected, right, series of governmental authorities with different structures, you see how this can lead to a republic and to democracy. But as part of the social contract discussion, you also have those push back and talk about, no, it's not just merely convention, there is some sense of natural law. And in particular, you have people like Locke and many others that I won't go through right now developing this idea, and we have in particular the language that we've begun to see, right? Life, liberty, right? The pursuit for Locke of property, and this is in his classic work, Two Treatises of Government. He develops many of these ideas, and Locke actually marries sort of the natural law and social contract tradition, which we then already saw quickly makes its way into the Declaration of Independence as well, where essentially Jefferson takes the fusion of these two and adopts it as sort of the foundational tenet, sort of twin principles of our republic. And so that's just a very short, unrepresentative, quick history of natural law in Western thought, but just to give some context of its religious context, its non-religious context, sort of some of the key thinkers that are involved in it. And so now we come to the question of where it fits into Jewish thought. And here I want to start, before we even get to the question of halakha, and say, are there any sources, even leaving aside halakha, is there anything in the Jewish tradition that could possibly account for or indicate that we should go in this direction? I want to share some sources with you. So take a look at source number 6 as an example, just to stimulate some thought. Classic Gemara in Masechet Eruvin and Daf Kuf Amud Beis. And the Gemara tells us, Amar Rabbi Yochanan said Rabbi Yochanan, Il Male Lo Nidna Torah, had the Torah not been given, Hayinu Lemeidin Sni Ut Me Chatul, we would have learned modesty from the cat, V'gezel Min Mala, right, the prohibition against theft from ants, V'arayot Miyona, right, fidelity from pigeon, derech eretz mitarnigal, proper sexual relations from the rooster, shemifayis viachar kach bo'el, who engages in a certain kind of order in that behavior. So let's read this again. Had the Torah not been given, we would have learned ethics from the animal kingdom. Okay, although they were living with, perhaps with, I don't know if you have any pets, but they were perhaps living on farms and so on and so forth. With the, anyone who lives in Yerushalayim, by the way, can tell you all about cats and their habits. So
I don't think anyone's going to learn anything about cats.
Right, that's actually a little bit of a kasha on this, right?
So I was thinking of saying, no, animals were slaves. Were slaves. Learn that animals does not mean slaves.
Okay, great. So, right, you're asking a little bit of a fair question, right? Forget slavery. What else do we find in the animal world?
Natural law.
Might is right. Natural law of the other kind, right? Of the war of all against all. I mean, what do you think Darwin was talking about, right? I mean, right?
Survival of the fittest, right?
All right, I mean, right? That's survival of the fittest, right?
Slavery, that's...
No. I'm saying not slavery, but I mean, right. So, but I think you're pointing out something really important, which is this Gemara is a little bit difficult to understand, because... Right? I mean, we can learn... Maybe there's some really wonderful things we can learn, and there are, right? I mean, I don't know. Am I the only one here who grew up learning about ants and hard work and all the, you know? Oh, come on. Right? Right? I mean, like, they pick... Look what they pick up over... You know what I'm talking about, right? Okay. To build an anthill. So, right? So, or the incredible organizations of the queen... Or of the bees, or the queen bee, and all of that. Right. But, obviously, the flip side is you can learn lots of other things from the animal kingdom, but
there are quite a lot of slaves.
What?
That's right. Not a slave.
That's
a drone. You got to be careful there. Right?
Very good. Touché.
She's good. Everybody else is.
One purpose to serve the queen.
Serve the queen. Yeah, that goes back to our earlier discussions about, right? That's, everyone serve humanity, right? To serve the queen. Interesting. Okay, but I mean, but.
So what is it trying to tell us?
And trying to tell us something, and it's trying to tell us something that's... But I just want to point out before I'm gonna offer an explanation. But before doing that, I think it's number one, it's before halacha. So that's an important limitation. Number two, we have a question, a problem, a serious analytical problem on the table, which is this is all too convenient to list. So how do we account for all the negative behavior of the animal kingdom? But leaving those really important points aside for just the moment, at minimum, what it seems to indicate that had the Torah not been given natural law, or at least I would say not natural law, but maybe natural morality, is somehow legitimate. It's what the Gemara does seem to be saying. Right? I mean, you can't get around it. What?
So what?
So what? You're saying so what for us after the Torah's given?
Yeah, I mean, we're not disputing with it. I mean, there's no dispute that natural law exists. It's just whether we live by it.
Good. So what this is saying is it had the Torah, or maybe before the Torah was given. Right, so that's interesting. So if I'm a Jew living in Egypt, if I'm Avraham Avinu or Yitzchak or Yaakov, there's some natural law before that God didn't tell us anything that we somehow infer using our own sense of logic, and that would be the basis on which I would know right from wrong. And maybe we'd still be doing that, except that's imperfect. It's a problematic or imperfect system over the long haul, maybe. And therefore, we require halakha as a way of sort of...
And maybe our real point is just being facetious.
Yeah, what do you mean?
If we didn't have halakha, then we'd be sitting here learning from the cat, learning from the rooster.
But it says we learned tsniut mechatzul. You're saying we learned the wrong things?
No, I'm saying is that if we didn't have halakha, that's where we'd be left with. We have to see this from...
I agree the Gemara has limited import, but I think that's going too far. It's really not how it's generally understood by the commentaries. If you read the Mepharshim, it's not. They do take it at face value.
We used to learn these things even with the Torah.
For sure. From them? Yeah, but we don't really need them anymore.
Maybe it's saying,
I mean, if you could learn from the cat or you could learn from God, what would you choose?
Well, obviously.
Okay.
Maybe it's saying, as you said, that it is natural morality, but we might not follow it. Like, it's there. We could learn it from them, but we really need halacha and the Torah because we need Yirat Hashem to really follow it. I mean, maybe that's what it's about.
Right.
It's there. Natural morality is there. We could learn it from other things, but would we really follow it? Do we need something stronger than both spheres to really...
Right. Well, I think that's right. In other words, the Torah is there for a reason, and I think that's a piece of it. You need a real system. And yeah, you need, it's just human nature. You can't just let people, and just sort of this like naive sense that, you know, people always gravitate to do what's good. It doesn't work. Yeah. Dor HaMavel or whatever, yeah.
Stone.
doesn't end well. You need police, you need rules, you need structure, and you need enforcement. Period, end of story. The history of humanity makes that much clear. Okay, but so I do think the Gemara should be taken at face value. I do think it's saying that had the Torah not been given, we really could have learned these things. But there's a problem, and so I'll just share with you my understanding of the Gemara. I don't actually believe, in light of the question that we asked about, well, we could have learned all sorts of negative characteristics from the animal kingdom. I don't believe that we're actually learning them directly from the animal kingdom. I think that we're learning them from ourselves in this Gemara. Learning them from ourselves might be because we're divinely created and therefore somehow that's God's form of revelation, or just there's some sort of natural compass or moral compass. But I think the point is like this. We have, without the Torah, we have within us some sort of moral compass, some sort of sense of right and wrong. It might not be enough to sustain society over the long term, but it's there, it's legitimate, and it's real without the Torah. Now, in order to arrive at that awareness, though, sometimes we need prompts. We all know that sometimes whatever we think of on our own pales in comparison at times to opportunities or exposures that we have, powerful experiences, or just what we see in others, certain models that we see, certain individuals who behave in a way that really is inspirational. We've all had that. We've all seen some sort of inspirational, some moment or some person in our lives, or that we've been exposed to, that really gives us a sense of, wow, I could raise my game and I can do better. And so to me, what the Gemara is saying is not that it's inherent in the animal kingdom, this goodness, but rather we have a sense of decency, but we might not always be attuned to those values until we see them. And we can see those not only in fellow human beings, but we can even see those in animals. And we can learn from them. But not that, therefore, we can learn everything from the animals because they're inherently moral all the time, but rather it can give us a greater sense of our own moral intuition. So that's how I read the Gemara, and I think that helps to resolve that problem. But I think we do see that there's some place for, if not natural law, natural morality. Now, we have another interesting example in the Chizkuni, in source number 3. Again, prior to Matan Torah, so it's limited in terms of what it gives us, but I think it's stimulating in terms of how to think about these issues, and that maybe at least at one point there's some legitimacy to some idea of natural law within Judaism, even if it's somewhat limited, which I think is really interesting to think about. Chizkuni is one of the classical commentators in Torah, in source number 7. English, I'll translate. Okay, so the Chizkuni, this is in Parshat Noach, Perek Zayin, I think it's Pasuk Chaf Aleph. So he asks a pretty basic question. He says, on what basis, v'im tomar, eich ne'enshu dor hamabul? It's a pretty basic question. On what basis was the generation of the flood punished? Me'achar shelo nitztavu al hamitzvot. Since after all, they were not commanded upon the mitzvot. Right? Who was commanded the 7 mitzvot?
Who's commanded?
Yeah. The 7 Gentile commandments. We know 613 for us, 7 for the Gentiles, called those Sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach. Who received those commandments? Right? Sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach. According to the rabbinic tradition, when does Noach receive those commandments? At what point? Before the flood? Is it after the flood? Well, apparently it's after the flood. And in fact, it's in chapter 9 in Perek Tet. There are a series of psukim that Chazal and the Gemarot and Masechet Sanhedrin derive as the basis, perhaps they're hints, perhaps they're really what the psukim mean, whatever it may be, but those are the basis for the 7 Noahide laws. Okay, so the flood happens, takes place before that. Basic question, says the Chizkuni, hey, did God ever come to them and say, you know, all this depraved behavior, this is unacceptable? Right? So God destroyed the world. He wiped everyone out. On what basis? It's troubling. Did he warn them? Did he tell them? Did they know? I mean, maybe Noah was warning them, but interesting question. So he has two answers. He says, "V'yesh lomar, yesh kama mitzvot shechayavim b'nei adam l'shomran." There are numerous mitzvot, or some mitzvot, that human beings are obligated to guard or to observe. Mikoach svarat hadat, on the basis of intellectual reasoning alone. Afal pi shelo nitztavu, even though they were not commanded as such. Ulefichach ne'enshu, and therefore they were punished. Kimo Kaya, as Kaya. Shine'enash al shvichut damin, who was punished for murder. Whom did he murder? Right? His brother, right? God didn't come to Cain and say, hey, right, just make sure this is one of the big seven for you, okay, and then it's going to be the big ten, all right? This is it, right? Don't murder your brother. God never says so. And Cain's, right? Cain's punished, right? He's not put to death, but he's punished, and an entire generation is wiped out on the basis of a lack of a command. Apparently, there's some intuitive sense of all that. Says, but maybe not. Oh, Shema, maybe we can hold our ground. Al Hagezel Atzmo Nitzav. Maybe there are seven commandments. So one of the seven is theft. So maybe when it comes to theft, there was some revelation. What's the problem? Right? It's not there. I mean, you kind of made it up. Maybe, and maybe the generation of the flood were killed for theft, and there was some revelation about theft, but it says Hamas, right? It says that they were killed because of the Hamas, which sounds like it's theft, but the command about the theft we don't find. The command for Cain, that killing his brother, we don't find, although he's at least not killed. But so he's kind of grasping at straws, maybe, but you see that there's sort of this sense that it's really hard to read Sefer Bereishis without some sense, a real strong sense of not just natural morality, but of natural law. A natural law that can account for the destruction of an entire generation. That's pretty substantial. Now, that doesn't take away from Kenny's point at all. In other words, in fact, it may prove Kenny's point, right? Look what happens when you try to construct a society on the basis of natural morality alone, right? It all falls apart, right? This is what we were talking about. So the argument kind of cuts both ways in terms of what it recommends for us moving forward, but I think that it's out there.
Although,
yeah.
So Cain exhibits natural law tendencies. He gets angry. He lashes out. Whether he intended to kill him or didn't, whatever, he killed him.
What do you mean natural law tendencies?
Cain is,
you mean
not
like,
governed by anything.
Like a Hobbesian natural law?
He's not governed, right? He's just existing, and he's bringing...
He's held accountable as exhibit.
But that's what I'm saying. So he exhibited natural law.
We'll see what you're saying.
Can I finish what I'm saying? Thank you. He's exhibiting an activity being not governed by anything other than natural law, which means he felt he was right, he felt he was wronged by somebody else, so he lashed out, because there's no law saying he can't. Mm-hmm. He was just going, might is right, he went over and he killed him, but then there is accountability. So natural law now has been, it's not a social contract per se, but we are being instructed with, this was wrong. You can't do this. In fact, he wore that symbol on his head. And now, for many generations subsequently, there is something that's being communicated that, although it wasn't necessarily as a law or a commandment, I mean, there was something to work from. So it wasn't as if there was, none, at least even by tradition, there would have been something beyond natural law that...
So you're saying that there's some sort of movement or transition from sort of an open, unstructured society towards something that's a little bit more structured.
There's no pure natural law. Because it was influenced by this deity, by God, throwing them out, well, giving a consequence because of an action may not have inherently seemed wrong. What you weren't told was wrong. Because it was wrong, there is a consequence, and in fact, it was being for penal purposes. I mean, you're going to have to walk around, and I want everybody to know they can't kill you, because killing is, that would be wrong, whatever that means, whatever that meant to them. But there's no longer, it's not reliant on natural.
That is interesting. Think about that. But the question is sort of the larger question in Sefer Bereishit is sort of, you know, this notion of can you read Sefer Bereishit without natural law? And I'm not sure that you can. I'm not sure that's problematic, but it is an argument for its significance.
Because they're held accountable to something, but then there is no Torah.
before, and there's no revelation at all. So being punished, or entire generations are being wiped out, or they're being spread across the globe. It's apparently a punishment, and so on and so forth. But without anyone have ever told them not to do so. So how are they supposed to know any better? The answer is
nothing but natural law to govern themselves.
Well, I wonder though, I know this is going to sound...
This is the argument.
This is going to sound a little crazy, but like, I mean, the idea that God spoke to Adam, mm-hmm. you know, in, you know, Gan Eden, and gave him a rule, a law.
Right.
I mean, could there be a suggestion that there were other laws given, or there were other things communicated, this was just one of them? I mean...
Possible. I think that that's really important, and I think you're right to point to that, because what it says is that the notion of a law, and not just natural law, but a revealed law, is foundational, I think. It's hard, I mean, you could always read it as just a story in Gan Eden, but we assume that the stories in Gan Eden are trying to tell us something greater and longer in terms of the historical arc. And so I think the fact that we start off humanity with a command, and it's a command that's violated, and that there's a consequence for it, that there's a punishment for it, in terms of exile, I think is really significant, and I think does make an important statement. Does that mean that we can infer that there were other specific laws? Anything is possible, but that's the kind of argument that we'd have to make in order to move away from what seems to be the obvious conclusion in terms of natural law being central to Bishop. There are those thinkers who suggest, and there's some debate about this, but there are those who think that essentially the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach are at core natural law.
Right.
There is a significant, and there are serious authorities, none less than Rav Nissim Gaon, who was 1,000 years ago a really, really a first-rate thinker. It's published in the introduction to our Gemara Brachot, our introduction to Shas. And literally, the first page of introduction to Shas says exactly this. He says, why did the Bnei Noach have to listen to these? Did God come and tell them? And did they have a Navi? And who explained it to them? And he says it's based on Uvnita Deliba, which roughly translates as some instinct of the heart. And that's the basis, he says, for Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. That's where they come from. The Rambam may disagree. The Rambam seems to say that has to be accepted based on the fact that they're revealed from Hashem. You can't be a Ger Toshav to receive a certain kind of status in Eretz Yisrael without that sense of commandedness. Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. Some debate about that, but that's one way of understanding the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach as well. So, okay, we're going to stop here for this evening. We're going to continue next time with some passages from Rav Kook. The Nitzid has some really foundational things about this, and since we're in Philadelphia, quote Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and then we'll see some examples of those who push back and don't think that natural law has that place in our tradition, and then followed from there, we'll circle back to the social contract. We'll see that also it's a very quick overview, its historical progression in the Western thought, and then see that's harder already, but is there any Jewish piece to that? And then we'll fuse those together as we conclude this segment. Sure.